Hi, welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Great to have you here with us. Get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy. You can get a hold of Golf News Net on your favorite social media service at the handle Golf News Net. We're starting to do a little bit more Facebook again. So we're trying to get back into that after we kind of basically left the service for the entire year to this point, which you may have noticed. And I wouldn't blame you for unfollowing us at that point. But hey, if you had, head back over there and follow us. We might do some fun stuff over there as well. Of course, we're on Twitter. We do a little bit of Instagram. That's starting to pick up a little bit more. And of course, we would love for you to download our apps for Roku and Amazon Fire TV devices. We are presented by our friends at TGA Premier Sports. Do you have a passion for sports? Do you enjoy working with kids, seeing them learn and grow? Then you can combine those passions and make them your job by becoming a TGA Premier Sports franchise owner. TGA Premier Sports is a franchise-based business and is designed to eliminate barriers to youth sports for kids and parents alike by bringing enrichment programs, camps, leagues, all of that kind of post-school stuff to children where they are, including in the schools where they work and play, as well local community centers and other places in the area. Local franchises have served more than 800,000 children in chapters throughout the United States and Canada, bringing in-school and in-center instruction and development in a variety of sports, including golf and tennis, and as well, several team sports, all part of a curriculum built on a foundation of academics and life skills. As a franchise owner, you'll be given the business tools to succeed right away using a proven turnkey model already employed by an active, helpful network of fellow franchise owners. You can learn more about TGA Premier Sports franchise opportunities at their website by going to playtga.com/franchise. Again, that's playtga.com/franchise. If you've listened to the podcast that I've done over the years with Josh Jacobs, who is the owner of TGA, he is one of my favorite people and one of the people I actually consider a genuine friend in this sport. A really great guy who runs a really smart business at TGA Premier. And he's doing really cool stuff to grow the game. I mean, they're doing it at a grassroots level, not at a country club level, not at a level where it seems like it's kind of helping, but not really. I look at the first tee, spots it works and others it doesn't. But TGA Premier works, man, and he really believes in what he's doing. And I love when he tweets about the cool things that happen, not only with TGA Premier, but just in general, in this line, sports change lives. And they really do. I mean, they changed mine. That's why I work in golf. If you have that inkling, if you have that interest in running a business and helping children, working with kids, seeing the smiles on their faces every day, then head over to playtga.com/franchise. You will thank me for it. Anyhow, this week on the show, we're going to talk a little bit about the British Open, talk about the Open Championship. I cannot tell you the number of emails, okay, like six, I got from folks overseas, primarily in the UK, saying, please stop referring to it as the British Open. No such thing exists. Or, I really love your website, but you keep calling it the British Open. Please don't do that. And I email them back every time, very politely, because I get it. Everyone's kind of stuck in the mud about something. And for these folks, it's the name of the tournament. And I say to them, well, predominantly my audience, at least the website audience, is American. 70 to 80% of people on any given day come to my website from the United States. And for them, for most of them, it's called the British Open. And the Associated Press refers to it as the British Open, so there's no confusion with the U.S. Open or French Open or Canadian Open or all the other Opens. And the most important part of this probably is from a monetary perspective. When people search the year's third major, which will be the year's fourth major next year, when they search that on social media, or they search it on Google, or they search it on Bing, if you use that for some reason, whoever you're searching, you use British Open. You know, most people don't do like the Open or the Open Championship. It's not how it works. So if I want people to come to my website to read my stuff about that major, I'm going to call it the British Open. I call it the British Open Championship as somewhat of a compromise because it is the Open Championship, but people need to know it's the British Open. And then most people respond with nothing because they're like, oh, wait, I get his reasoning. It means something to him. But that kind of pedantic argument aside, we got a classic, man. I mean, what a great Open we had at Carnoustie. And if you look at the last three, 1999 was Jean Vandeveld. And that was really one of the first years I ever watched golf with any kind of seriousness. Like, I'm sure I watched golf before 1999 because there was 1997 and the Masters. And I probably watched the first real golf tournament I can remember watching is like the 1995 PGA Championship, 1996 PGA Championship, something like that. And the 1999 Open is one of those that's just kind of seared in my brain because of the craziness that happened. But still, I went and rewatched that final round replay that Golf Channel showed at least once, maybe twice, and just couldn't get over now having seen it 20 years later and all that I've learned about golf and watched golf and seen so many things happen in golf, and it still blows my mind that it worked out that way. And then it still blows my mind how bad that playoff was. I mean, it was the weather was terrible, the course was impossible, but the quality of golf was just downright crappy until they got to 17, and then all somehow birdied it and made it really interesting. Or yeah, it was 17. Somehow all birdied it. And then 18 to wrap it up, and Lowry wins. It's kind of uneventful. Like, hey, wait, he won. Amazing. Scottish guy wins. And comes from 10 behind. And then you had 2007. You had, again, the 72nd hole, really key, with Harrington's drive bouncing across the bridge slash walkway and all of the travails of the double bogey there and thinking he got away from him. Then he gets into the playoff with Sergio, and Sergio thinks God's against him, probably was, and he doesn't pull it off. Harrington wins, and then wins the next year, and then bludgeons Garcia again at the PGA Championship like 3 weeks later after he repeats his champion. Like, he basically shivved Sergio Garcia two times in a 13-month stretch. I mean, just outright shiv, left him on the floor. And it's just it's stunning to look back on that. And we'll look back on this major in the same way. And we had everybody and everything outside of Justin Thomas and Dustin Johnson a part of it. The, you know, world number one and two players, because they missed the cut. And you had Tiger Woods vying for a 15th major to win the first major coming from behind slash without a share of the 54-hole lead. He had the lead alone for an hour on Sunday. That felt like an eternity, and it felt like he was going to do it, and it was amazing. And I'm so happy that I got to watch that. But then you had Rory McIlroy make a great comeback. You had Justin Rose almost get there. He had a great, great Saturday and Sunday. I mean, just to make the cut on the number, that birdie on 18 kind of felt like on Friday, like, all right, he's going to get in. Now he can do something. If you made the cut, you could do something. You had a chance to win. And I feel that way particularly about the two Opens. I don't feel that way as much about the Masters or the PGA. But in the two Opens, the U.S. and the Open, when you get to the weekend, you have a chance. You can win. And that almost bore out to be true. And then you had Jordan Spieth, who I reluctantly thought in the back of my mind when we got to Sunday. And you had Kisner, Schauffele, and Spieth there at -9, figuring -9's not going to win. It's not going to be higher than -9, or excuse me, I guess lower than -9. It's not going to be -10. We're not going double digits. Not with the wind expected. Not with the conditions finally getting to what you think of the nastiest car Newstie can be. And you figured probably eight or nine would do it. And those guys just absolutely wet the bed right out the gate in the final two groups. Meanwhile, you have Francesco Molinari and you have Tiger Woods playing unflappable golf in the third to last group. And it was a sight to behold, primarily because of what Woods was doing. Like, all right, he's made two birdies. He's got the lead. This could really happen. He played such great controlled golf until 11. And I kind of forgot about what Molinari was doing and how wonderful he had played up to that point in the round. It's just, all right, another par for Molinari. Well, he's not going away. Well, kind of in the back of my mind, I figured eventually something's going to get him, even though he had just played his last couple of tournaments in win second place, you know, on the PGA Tour. One, I mean, they're the two weakest events of the year, to that point. He won the Quicken Loans National by a zillion, Tigers tournament, curiously enough, and then finished second at the John Deere when Michael Kim blew everyone away. So separating him from the pack, you know, basically won against the best of the rest. And I never thought until about 12 or 13, really, I guess after the double bogey, started thinking, wait, Molinari hasn't made a mistake yet, and the wind has turned. Now they're at the point in the golf course where the wind plays down for the last six holes. Maybe he can do this. And Spieth never recovered from early bumbles. His mistake on six to try to hit some kind of fairway wood out of the high stuff and then to put it in a gorse bush, that was one of the dumber things I've ever seen him do on a golf course. And usually he somehow gets paid out. Somehow he gets to executing the shot, or he gets a good break, or both. And it all works out okay because he's Jordan Spieth. Or at least that's what we thought. And he never figured it out. Never got it back. Finished on minus four. Had 76 in the final round. He played like a guy who was absolutely lost from the start and knew, given his season, he had no business winning this tournament. But he could have just as easily pulled together an even par 71 and won the thing. That's all he needed was even par. It sounds like a lot given the way the scoring fell on Sunday, but that's it. And I have to credit Xander Schauffele for coming back. I mean, he was left for dead heading to that final seven or eight holes. And he got close. He almost did it. Now, he kind of gave one away there that could have given him a chance on the 72nd hole, other than some kind of miracle eagle type attempt. But I have to give him credit for getting back there. And then for Tiger played really great. And I've gotten mixed reaction from that, doing kind of radio interviews after the fact. And some people have asked me, hosts of radio shows, do you think Tiger kind of choked? Did he give it up? And I come back to this point. First of all, Tiger entered the day four shots behind. So he needed gifts from the four guys in front of him to make a run. And he was given those early with the early mistakes, especially by the three guys sharing the lead. He took advantage of those. Didn't take full advantage of those, but he took his best advantage probably as expected and held the lead alone for an hour. You knew Carnoustie would pretty much get everybody once on Sunday. Pretty much. That was in contention. And 11 was the hole that got Tiger. He compounded the error by trying to kind of get his way out of a bad tee shot on 11 when he could have just kind of run it up there. And he tried to muscle it out. I think that was a mistake. And then he compounded the error by trying to hit a really difficult flop-style shot when he could have just taken his medicine, hit the green, and made bogey. But even still, if he had done that, birdied 14 and gotten to the last and somehow birdied that and instead of letting that pass, he still would have lost by one to Molinari. So he needed a lot of help, and he basically needed to play a perfect round on a really difficult day to do that. He didn't do that, but he did hold the lead, and he did look pretty comfortable doing it, and he didn't seem all that fazed by the fact that he was in the cauldron, and I think he was excited about it. And he held his wits about him. A lot of guys don't do that. The exception to this whole kind of Sunday fallout was Molinari, that he played bogey-free golf. That he didn't drop a shot, that he only went forward. That just doesn't typically happen. So, especially on a golf course in those kinds of conditions like Carnoustie. So you have to give credit to Molinari for a brilliant 37 final holes. He's the first guy since Steve Elkington in 1995 to play a bogey-free weekend and win a major championship. And he played with a really smart game plan. He didn't have to force anything. He knew really early, just like Tiger or anybody else that was chasing, that the guys were coming back. And all he had to do was just kind of hang around, get the holes he could get, save where he needed to, and he made some remarkable saves. But that was all he had to do, was just not make mistakes and do a couple of things better than everybody else. And that's what he did. I take a lot of positives from what Tiger did. I think he can win the PGA Championship. For a couple of different reasons. One, I don't think he really needs driver to get around Bellerive. Two, it's a course no one in the field has really seen competitively unless you played in the 2008 BMW Championship on the PGA Tour, and that was not a very good event that week. I think, if I remember right, Camilo Vijaygas won that tournament, but maybe it was Vijay. But either way, it was part of that run where no one understood how the playoffs were working, and you got like 200,000 points for it. It was just nonsense. And before that, you have to go back to the early 90s. I think it was, what, 92 or 93 for the PGA Championship when Nick Price won. So nobody, I mean, basically nobody has been around for 25 years. It's just like, can't wait to get back to Belrive. So you've got Tiger there, one of the best thinkers in the game. I think you got to put him in terms of course management right up there with Jordan Spieth, although he's increasingly making dumb decisions. So I feel like if Tiger can play the style of golf that got him through Saturday and maybe don't take the first two rounds and play conservatively on Friday, come out the gate blazing on Thursday, hang out on Friday, see where that leaves you, whichever the day that might be the better part of the draw, or if not, just pick a day and go guns blazing. Go for it on Saturday like he did. Very smart change in game plan. It worked for him, got him into contention. And then on Sunday, see where that leaves you. And at the PGA Championship on Sunday, you're not going to probably play for pars. You're going to play for, you know, 300 or 400 pars. The final round will probably get you the job done. So I think that's where he needs to go. That's what he needs to look for. And if he can do that, he can win. And I think he gets a really nice warm-up next week at Bridgestone, the final one. He could win that for a ninth time. There is still a way for him to play his way on the Ryder Cup team. And I'm very excited about the prospects of him moving forward. Now I am convinced more than ever, not only will he win, but he can, not that he will, but that he can win another major championship. You know, we talked for so long about the magic being gone and not being there. I'm willing to discount the 11th hole on Sunday as something that happened to everybody. Because all of a sudden we'll go, Jordan Spieth is dead because of what he did on Sunday. But although, I think that's an extremely interesting topic. I'm very curious where Jordan Spieth is going to be in 2 or 3 years. And I say that because his style of golf is catching up to him. It's not beautiful golf. At times, it's the most gorgeous thing you've ever seen, but around the other mistakes, the other problems, the other meltdowns, it's not a beautiful piece of art. And so he walked into Sunday coming off of basically a horrible last year since winning this tournament, found a way to get around Carnoustie really well, got himself into contention, seemed like, all right, well, this is just who Spieth is. He's going to get into contention to win one or two majors a year, and maybe he wins one of them, maybe he wins another, and that's a good year, and he's just going to rack them up. And now, looking back, he has basically given away as many majors as he's won. And if you want to be really specific, two of the majors that he's won, there are very good chances in both of those that he didn't win them. I mean, he did, obviously, that means something. But if Dustin Johnson doesn't three-putt from 12 feet, maybe he wins the playoff on Monday at Chambers. If it weren't for the greatest five holes you've ever seen in major championship golf, he certainly doesn't beat Matt Kuchar. And this Sunday at Carnoustie was not very good. So, as I've said, I've repeated this a few different times, so if you've listened to me other places in the last few days, I'm sorry, but I think it's an important point. Spieth can be one of two people, basically, on the extremes at this point. He can be a Jack Nicklaus kind of guy, and I don't mean he's going to have his career, but Jack Nicklaus had 37 second or third place finishes in major championships. He still managed to win 18 of them. He didn't let losing bother him. He was happy to be there, knowing that sometimes it just wasn't going to work out. But there are so many examples of other players who got there a lot of times, and Ricky Fowler's becoming one of them, that you get there and you just fold like a house of cards because it's happened too many times. It's too easy to do it. You know how to fold. You don't know how to shove in. You don't know how to win. And it's really hard to push yourself through it. And Phil Mickelson was one of those guys who took so many L's, but one day it worked. And he figured out how to win five majors. And honestly, probably could have won seven. But has five majors in hand, has a tremendous career. And while he didn't entirely live up to his potential, he largely has. And that's because one day it clicked and he realized what it took and he ran with it. So I don't know where Jordan Spieth is going to fall in this. But I'm really curious because he is definitely at a crossroads. His short putting has become a problem. Not that it hasn't been before, but it's a glaring one now. And it seems like the breaks are evening out. We talked for so long about Jordan Spieth gets all the breaks. Everything goes his way. Everything works out for him. Well, the law of averages eventually tells you it's going to go the other way. It's going to even out, more or less. And it seemingly has started to. So what is Spieth going to do from here? What does he have to do from here? I don't know that he really has to do anything, but he needs to tidy up his short game, tidy up those putts, make better decisions on the golf course, not put himself behind the eight ball, because that double on six was his own doing, and that got him into this tailspin he could not recover from. Xander Schauffele is going to win a major. I'm convinced of that. And he's a tough guy. I think he's got some majors in his future. Kevin Kisner pulled something out of thin air. He's basically been in contention to win two of the last four major championships on Sunday. I think he can figure one out someday. Hope he can. I love watching Kisner play golf. But to Molinari, he's your classic 35-year-old guy having the best year of his life. And we may never, ever see him win a major again. But he's also been in contention to win two of the last four, like Kisner, same tournaments, PGA Championship and this Open. Curious what that means moving forward for him. Obviously, a lock to be on the Ryder Cup team, might be considered a veteran at this point. There are a lot of guys on the team who are relatively fresh-faced. Curious how that'll work out. Same thing for the American side. Jordan Spieth and Ricky Fowler are the bottom half of the automatic qualifying eight. If some crazy stuff happens in the next few weeks, they could be on the outside looking in. I think you have to pick at least Spieth, maybe not Fowler, but you got to pick at least Spieth to be on the team if he doesn't make it on points. But you unless Tiger and or Phil play their way into the top eight, you have to pick them. There's no doubt you're going to pick them. So you have two spots left, basically. I think one, if Schauffele makes it on points, he's in. You save that spot. Maybe you give it to Tony Finau. If he doesn't, then he's a pick. Got to have him. Then who? You got this kind of circling of maybe Kuchar, Finau, Schauffele. Depends on who's kicked out of the top eight, if anything happens in the next couple of weeks, and go from there. So there's a lot of intrigue coming out of this that we just don't know yet. But I think that's just a tack on to why this has been such a great Open, why it was such a great Open, and what it can mean for the world of golf going as it is right now. The world just kind of spun on its axis a little bit, and it's pointing in a different direction. That's why majors are so consequential in my mind. All right, so we've got a guest this week, and his name is Tom Coyne, and hopefully you know Tom's work. Tom is a brilliant writer. And you probably know him from his book, of course, called Ireland or Paper Tiger. He's kind of an experiential writer who has this tremendous sense of self, but also how golf works, the spirit of the game, what it means to immerse yourself in it. And he's done so many good pieces of writing over the years that I hope you've seen him. He's seen his work, seen his bylines, seen his covers of his books, have his books. But he's out with a new book, and it's called A Course Called Ireland. So basically the sequel to A Course Called Ireland. And we've been meaning to put this together for a few weeks. And we got together on Skype during the week of the Open, had a conversation about the book, about his travels. I figured coming out of the whole week that was the Open, it would probably be better to talk about playing golf in Scotland after the fact, because you would be so jazzed about what you saw, that hopefully maybe you'll one day go over there and get to experience it. I still haven't played golf over in either in the United Kingdom or in Ireland. I hope that changes next year, but and I anticipate it changing next year, but haven't done it yet. So I wanted to bring Tom on, talk about his book, and then just kind of get geeked out about playing golf in Scotland. But first, before we bring you that interview, want to tell you about the Myrtle Beach World Amateur Handicap Championship. We are closing up shop soon on registration. It's about a month away. Actually, a month from today is when it's going to kick off down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. You basically get to play four rounds of handicap golf on some of the best courses and the best place to play golf in the United States. The Grand Strand is one of my favorite spots. You know it. I talk about it plenty. I've been there three times this year, and I will be there for two consecutive weeks, one for a family vacation with 29 people in a house, and the next week for the World Am. By participating, not only do you get those four rounds, you potentially get a fifth round in the championship flight. If you win your flight, you get to play on Monday and get a pro tour style experience for the title of the best of the best, winning the Myrtle Beach World Am. You get a $300 gift bag just for showing up. All kinds of great goodies, including things from Greg Norman Apparel. So you basically are getting your money back in terms of the goodie bag that you get just for playing. And then you get to experience the world's largest 19th hole with me and Mitch Lawrence. Mitch Lawrence lives down there. It's just a blast to be in the Myrtle Beach Convention Center. Open bar, cocktails, hors d'oeuvres, finger food, all kinds of stuff. All kinds of golf exhibits and merchants and vendors at your disposal. Concerts, lots of fun. And then we get to hang out as well. So head over to thegolfnewsnet.com/worldam to get your last minute qualifying. You're going to save $100 on your entry form when you do that through us. So head over to thegolfnewsnet.com/worldam. All right, let's bring in Tom Coyne, our conversation from Skype. This was kind of put together a little bit piecemeal from a technical component, but it sounds really good, and I think you're going to love what Tom has to say. If you don't walk away from this with a smile on your face, I can't help you. So please enjoy this conversation with Tom. All right, Tom, thanks for joining us on the show. Really appreciate it. You're in Belfast right now, Northern Ireland, so not too far. Drive up the M1 from Portrush, which is going to host the Open Championship next year. And while you've tackled Ireland in a previous book, a course called Ireland, naturally, now we're going to talk about a course called Scotland, which is kind of your latest adventure of tackling basically an entire country's best golf courses. And that makes me extremely jealous, but also entirely empathetical in one sense because of how this entire thing came about. So for folks who maybe have not dug into your writing in the past, or have done Ireland and now are getting into Scotland, where in your life were you when you decided to embark on this adventure?
Yeah, so, I mean, as soon as I did Ireland, you know, everyone was asking me, okay, what are you doing in Scotland? And, you know, there's a fair gap in time in between the two because it took me a while to kind of decide that I wanted to do Scotland. There was, you know, of course, you know, as a writer, when everyone's telling you, oh, this is the story, I've got a story for you, you know, your natural inclination is to say, I'm not going to do that. But as a links-loving golfer, as this sort of chaser of links experiences, you know, not knowing Scotland was this huge hole in my golf resume, and I wanted to do it. I just wanted to figure out a way to, you know, a way that was a little bit different and a way that felt like it was something I had to do. And that's been the case with all the books. If I don't get to the point where it feels like I'm totally compelled, like that I have to be doing this, you know, then I'm not going to do it because it's, you know, it's 4 or 5 years of your life. And it really requires one to, I think, become like totally immersed and obsessed in the project for it to feel really special and interesting and different. And basically what I wanted to do was, and again, with all the stories, I want to go out and do something crazy, something extraordinary. I want to live like other golfers' dreams so that they can read this book and experience what their dream was like, you know, because, you know, not everyone can take 4 months to golf all of Ireland or take, you know, 57 days and golf all of Scotland. So in this book, the angle that I approached it with was that I wanted to find the secret to golf in the home of golf. You know, I've been looking for the secret to golf since I was 8 years old. So if it existed, you know, I figured it's got to be somewhere in Scotland. And so I started planning a trip that was originally just like the road of courses and then some more famous courses. And then it just started to grow and people were suggesting other places, and I had friends who'd been to places I'd never heard of, so I said, oh, I have to go there. And next thing you know, I had 107 courses on my list, all links courses, And I had 57 days to get it all done because I want the final round to be a qualifier for the Open Championship so that I could test what I learned.
And so you kind of go from early in the book from semi-reluctant / aware husband about this trip to, all right, we're going to do this. We're going to do this the right way. And taking over basically from there from your friend Robert, who kind of suggested this to you. What was that? Was that ramping up a single moment, kind of like you were describing earlier of, all right, we're going to do this. We're going to do this for real. And here we go, versus a kind of warming up to it. How did that all kind of play out?
Yeah, so it comes in like two parts. Like the first one is, which I write about in the book, is getting Allison, my wonderful, beautiful wife, to say, yeah, that's a good idea. And not to just say, okay, you know, if you have to do it, you have to do it. You know, I absolutely know two little kids now. That's been a big change since the Ireland book. That having an 8 and 5 year old daughter, you know, that I needed her full and absolute support. So getting that is sort of one of those aha moments. And then the second one is honestly, getting my publisher to say it's a good idea too. It's been a funny thing with doing Paper Tiger and of course Called Ireland. And, you know, you write these proposals, you come up with these crazy ideas and you kind of only half believe you're going to do them. And then someone says, yeah, that's a good idea. Here's a contract. Go do it. And you're like, shit, here I go. Now I have to do this. So then it becomes very real. But it's super exciting when that happens because, you know, you shift into total planning, total obsession. Every hour of every day, it's in your head. The book is in your head. And as a writer, that is such a beautiful place to be. And way to live. It's just sort of my comfortable natural state to have a project that I'm just thinking about all the time. And when I don't have that, I sort of feel a little unsettled.
You kind of mentioned early on in the book about the logistics of putting the whole trip together. You come up with your 107 courses or 107 rounds you have to play, the time you have to play it. How much did that get blown up over the course of those 57 days? How quickly did it get blown up, and how much did you build that explosion into how this probably would play out?
You know, it's funny. When I did the Ireland itinerary, I gave myself like off days. Like every sixth or seventh day was empty because I knew whether it would be weather or health or something was going to happen. So I gave myself that padding. But I didn't with Scotland. I just didn't have the luxury of it. So I was booking 36 and 54 holes a day every single day without a single day off. And that was insane. It meant that I had to play through. I mean, I played through weather in North Berwick like it was end of time stuff, like that I'd never experienced, that I didn't know you could experience in life. Unless you went to like, I don't know, the polar ice caps or something. But, you know, I didn't have the luxury of stopping. So the itinerary pretty much held together pretty well. I mean, there were moments, you know, there was a time in Cornwall, because I did England and Wales too, a little bit, where I got my tee times flip-flopped, but that day still kind of came together. And, you know, and certainly towards the end of the book, I actually get fogged in on an island because I went to the island courses as well. I wanted this to be like a totally no stone unturned, going everywhere. I couldn't come back and possibly think like, oh, well, what if the thing I had to learn was there and I didn't go there? So I wasn't going to do that. So I went everywhere. And on one of those far-flung islands, you know, I show up for my flight and they're just like, well, plane's not coming today. I have a ticket. I'm at an airport. What do you mean the plane's not coming today? They're like, well, it might not come tomorrow either. You know, there's fog. So, so I did have to roll with some of that, but I worked on this for like a year to have this ironclad itinerary because I knew it was the only thing that would keep me sane is knowing like my next stop, my next bed, my next tea time, etc. So it did hold together pretty well.
were there times over the course of that, the stretch of this trip, where you weren't perhaps as invested in a round as maybe you hoped to be? Or were there times on the opposite end where you thought, I just don't have it today, and at some point in the round, or maybe when you got to the course, or whatever point in the day, that you locked in and engaged in a way maybe you didn't anticipate?
All the time. I mean, there, that was like the daily grind and sort of struggle, was to stay focused and like keep caring, and to keep noticing and to stay aware of everything that's going on around me, because, you know, one, because what a waste it would be if I didn't, and two, I'm writing a book, so I can't really kind of like check out. Although there were certainly courses, there were some courses where I did just probably just zombied my way through a round of golf, you know, with like third round of the day, sun's going down. But you're right, it works the other way too. There's some of those rounds where you're like, all right, I'm just getting through this. And I can recall, you know, definitely, you know, at Newburgh, at Fraserburgh, at some of these courses where I thought, they're not like any big name course, I'll just get through this because I'm on my way to Castle Stewart or something. And you get out there and you realize, like, this place is awesome. And I am the luckiest person, golfer in the world, to be here right now. And you just sort of, and it was the beauty of it, it was the courses that would wake you up. You know, Scotland would remind me from time to time, like, check me out. Like, this is incredible. And so that was great. And then what also kept me sort of aware and alert were all these people coming to join me, and who had, most of them had never been to Scotland before, and had never, some had never seen a links before. So those friends who came are a huge part. I think the book is really about them, you know, more than anything. And they're the folks who let me see Scotland and links golf through fresh eyes. And that just, to me, was such a, I was so grateful for that. I really needed that. It really amped up the enthusiasm and the excitement for every day. I mean, my friend Garth, his line in the book is, "Hey Tom, you know what? We get to golf today." And he said it every morning. And as much as I wanted him to shut up and say something else, it was this great reminder that, like, thanks, man. You know what? I get to golf today. I could be at home painting the garage. So it was pretty good.
What do the different set of eyes, what does a fresh set of eyes that people have never seen golf courses like this, and you could fill in the blank with a variety of different golf courses in this country, in Northern, wherever in your journeys, but what to you is the difference between someone who's never seen a golf course like that, maybe never have even fathomed it if you hadn't brought them into it, versus you who's seen some of the finest places, the finest real estate in the world through the lens of golf?
Yeah, so it is really cool to be with people, and it happened this week, because right now I'm doing this thing called the Coin Cup that we do every year with Old Sod Travel, and we bring over friends and readers, and we come to courses that are in the book, and characters from the books like come and hang out. So it's a super fun event we do, and there were a lot of people here this week who signed up for the trip, and it's open to all comers if anyone's interested. There were a lot of people who had never played a links before. And so on the first day I went out with a couple guys who'd never been on a links course. And it's so fun. It's so interesting to see how they react to it, because, well, the first reaction is like complete terror, because they've seen, like, the only time they've seen a links is at the Open. It just looks really hard. And the wind looks just incredibly nasty, and they'll never get their ball out of the bunker, and they're carrying like 30 balls because they just expect to lose everything, you know? So first it's like fear. And so it takes them a couple of days to kind of get over that. But it's also fun to watch them kind of learn like how to hit different golf shots, and you know, all the distances on these courses are measured to the front of the green, because that's where you want your ball to land. If your ball lands pin high, your ball is gone. And so for them to kind of learn these lessons, one, it reminds me some of those lessons, but it also takes me back to like you know, in Ireland and in Scotland, figuring that stuff out again for myself. So it's just, it's super fun. It's like when you're, it's like having someone over, I don't know, to your home, or taking someone to your like favorite, you know, holiday place, and you just want to tell them everything about it and show them everything. I try to not do that because I've just become incredibly tedious and annoying as a host. But it's just, it's a lot of fun. And then for them at the end of the week, to say, you know, just to feel like, you know, that's the greatest golf I've ever played. That just feels awesome too. And it makes you realize like, I'm not crazy because I think Lynx golf is this, you know, Lynx golf is, you know, golf in its best form.
That was something I was going to ask, because it feels like golf is a game of self-discovery that you have to figure it out for yourself. You can't be told such and such or X or Y, that you have the truths you learned either about yourself or the sport or both over time. You have to figure it out, whether for good or for bad. You can't just be told, hey, this is what it is. Accept that. It's not like going to school in that regard. So is it, in your experience with the people, your experience and the people you've played with and the people who come on Coin Cup, et cetera, do they kind of have a different catharsis? Do they have a different eureka, or is it kind of the same for everybody?
No, for everyone, it's like, it's totally different. And it happens at different courses and in different moments. When they kind of get, when it clicks and they get it, you know, that this is why this is special, you know? And it's happened to, you know, there's a young kid with us this week, who the first couple of days was going out and playing, you know, high shots in American golf and was sort of trying to translate his good Florida golf to here. He was getting so frustrated because he was shooting, you know, he wanted to come over here and break par all over the place, and he was shooting 85. And something clicked yesterday, and he came in and shot, you know, he shot 74 at Royal County Down, he shot 75 at Port Rush today, and you can just see the look in his face, like it's like pure joy. And because he's figured something out, you know, it's clicked for him. He's had that moment, and it's different for everyone. I think it usually happens for people when they finally like execute a shot the way the golf course, you know, the way they use their imagination to do something they wouldn't have done at home, and it works out. You know, that's such a cool moment. Like, you know, you've got 120 and, you know, you've been hitting pitching wedges and you haven't gotten close to a green yet. So you pull out a 7-iron and you punch it and it hits short and rolls up and you have 6 feet for birdie, and you're just like, that was the coolest thing I've ever done. Even though it required me to swallow my ego and hit a 7-iron from 120 yards, you know, those are the moments, and they keep happening. You know, every time you do that, you're just like, I'm really playing a game. I'm really thinking. I'm really golfing my ball. And that's the joy, one of the joys of Lynx golf, for sure.
I have a preconceived notion about this, and maybe I'll be proven wrong over time, but I'm going to ask a leading question anyway, and is what do Scotland and Ireland and England and that cluster of countries, that their, what does their golf culture get right that ours doesn't in the United States?
Oh boy, how long is our podcast now? So, no, the Lynx stuff, that's huge, because they're blessed with this. They have dune land and Lynx land. They're blessed with that geography that we just don't have, and that's cool. But aside from that, yes, there are just a lot of, there are a number of things that I think that we could borrow from the way golf is here, you know, to golf at home. A few just obvious ones, like there are visitor tee times at every single golf course. So yesterday we're Royal County Down, today we're Port Rush. And these would be the most sort of esteemed, proper, the royal courses, you know, it's in their name. You would think I'll never be able to get on that golf course because it would be the American equivalent of Cypress or Augusta or Pine Valley. Yet both courses have visitor tee times. They're happy to have you come and play. Now, they don't have a ton, and they're expensive, but by doing that, it makes their membership incredibly affordable. And so it's not being a member at their club isn't making anyone broke because they have Americans showing up paying £1,000 for a foursome, one after the other after the next. So that scheme of like allowing visitors to play at private courses, that just makes sense to me. I don't know why we have this gated model of exclusivity. And it always struck me as funny that like, okay, Great Britain is supposed to be the snobby, aristocratic, exclusive place, right? And America's this land of bootstraps and every man and democracy and all this. Yet we treat golf, you know, in the exclusive way, while over here it's like, you know, it's a game. You just go out and play it, you know. I also love, hey, you can go out and play with your dog. Why don't we do that? You know, I think that's a no-brainer. They use trolleys, you know, otherwise known as push and pull carts, which there are still a lot of clubs that have stigmas at home about using that, and instead would have rather have people out in gas-powered carts. That doesn't make sense to me. So just those sort of small things, the day-to-day things of their golf, I really appreciate. I also appreciate that if you walk in the clubhouse with a hat on, you will quickly be told to take it off, which I think is awesome. I'm not like a curmudgeon-y guy, but that's just one thing that annoys me when you have a table full of Americans in a restaurant over here with their baseball caps on. It's like, dude, you know, when in Rome, just try to do what the Romans do. So there's a lot of little things, but I think overall it's just the spirit of like that this isn't a game. The playing golf isn't a status symbol, you know, and that exclusivity and all that stuff that we have too much of, I think, it's not a part of golf over here. The difference is there are some exclusive clubs, but the golf course itself is not exclusive. St. Andrews has six clubs attached to it. Five or six clubs. But the course itself is a public park. You can walk your, they close it on Sunday, so you can go out on the old course and have a picnic. Now that's cool, you know. Now joining the Royal and Ancient, yeah, that's a different thing. That's, you know, that's not open to any and all comers, but I think we could do better with all of that.
Not to kind of harp too much on the open rotation courses, but that those are going to be the ones that a lot of people who, whether they've ever played Lynx golf or not, that's what comes immediately to mind. Of those that you played, which one did you enjoy the most and why?
Well, it's funny. I just walked off Royal Portrush, so I'll start there. Even though it's a book, it's a course that's not in the Scotland book because it's a course I played in my Ireland book. And one wouldn't really consider it a rota course because it hasn't had the open since the 1950s, but it will next year. And so of all the courses to ever host an open, and now I've had the chance to play them all, Portrush is like almost on a different list. That's how good and I think that it is and how awesome I think the Open is going to be. You know, you go to a place like Hoylake, very great history, very challenging, long holes. But if you look at the landscape, the topography of Hoylake, and put it up against the topography of Portrush, I mean, you're like talking about two different planets. So Portrush is going to just be awesome. It's got hulking dunes. It's twisting and turning. It's just going to be a blast. So yeah, I put Portrush at the top of the list for sure. And then I'm a sentimentalist about the old. I mean, you know, even though that's probably of the rota courses in some ways, one of the more subdued courses. I mean, you probably get more wind there than anywhere else. It's just so exposed. But I just love everything. The first and 18th at St. Andrews, that's the altar of golf. It's just the coolest setting, and I love the town so much. So I have to definitely throw St. Andrews in there. And then probably Birkdale was one of the more interesting ones. Royal St. George's, super interesting as well. I don't want to not say Carnoustie, but Carnoustie is, you know, the three finishing holes, so tough, and that burn is like just vexing and cool and interesting, but sadly, probably not a course where I remembered as many holes as I would, as I, you know, at a place like Port Rush or Birkdale or certainly the Old Course even.
And then we'll get you out here on this. Of the courses that you played for this book, for Scotland, what were the one or two or three sleepers that maybe you didn't know as much about going in and you walked away a huge fan of?
Okay, cool. Yeah, so my sleeper picks, definitely a course called Shiskian, which is on the Isle of Arran off the west coast of Scotland. And you kind of can go through Arran on your way out to Macbranish. Knew nothing about it, except I knew there were some golf courses on Arran. I picked this one because it looked pretty cool. So we get there and we find out it's a 12-hole golf course, which is just awesome. And you know, I finish and I realize 12 holes is the perfect number of golf holes. We should have 12-hole golf courses everywhere. You have a front six and a back six. You play in 2.5 hours and you shoot 48 and you just feel awesome. You know, it's like, it's perfect. So, and it's also has these crazy rock formations everywhere. It's just, it's just stunningly beautiful as well. So that was a great sleeper. There was another course up not too far from Inverness as we started to get into the Highlands. Two courses up there, a place called Cullen, which is a short course. I'd say it's probably like par 66 or 68. Lots of par threes. But it's in this like beach cove where the sort of cliffs have been like washed out over millions of years, yet some of the cliffs remain. So it's like Paleolithic, like you're playing through these wacky rock formations and blind shots over stones and up against cave walls and just totally fun and nuts. And there's of course a nine-holer near there called Covesie, which has this is in a similar kind of cove. I mean, these are courses where you're like, what I tell people, I'm like, if Fred Flintstone golfed, these places he'd be golfing. Like, it is almost like you expect to find fossils there. I mean, I did not expect to find anything like that in Scotland. So those were just super, super finds.
All right. So for folks, hopefully you enjoyed this conversation. Tom, thank you so much for coming on. The book is, as we've said a couple different times, A Course Called Scotland. And while you're at it, if you haven't read it, go ahead and purchase A Course Called Ireland as well. You're going to love that too. These are kind of your Bibles you can work off of if you're, like me, dreaming of playing golf in these two places of the world in the not-too-distant future or as soon as you stop listening to this conversation. So, Tom, thanks again for making time from Belfast. We appreciate it.
Ryan, thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Tom Coyne for joining us. He was in Belfast doing that for his Coyne Cup. I can't wait to be up in that part of the world next year. I've committed to going to the Open for the first time because it's at Royal Portrush and because my son is named after the Carrickeried Rope Bridge, which his name is Carrick, and that means in Gaelic, rock. So it's kind of like Craig in Scotland. And we've been telling him for a while now, we want you to see your bridge, so to speak, and that's not too far from Royal Portrush. So what I'm hoping to do is bring my family over, my wife and two kids over. We'll see all that stuff for a little bit, then they can head home, and I'll do the Open Championship at Portrush. But I can't wait. I just can't wait to be over there for that. And then hopefully someday I can do something not quite as big as what Tom has done in either Ireland or Scotland, but just experience some of the amazing golf over there. It really, from everything I've ever been told, everybody has ever shared their experience with me, just the way that they enjoy the light bulb that goes off playing links golf, playing that style over there, just makes you wish we had that kind of real estate here that we could do it. Anyway, next week on the show, we'll talk a little bit about the Canadian Open. We'll talk about the Senior Open, which is at the old course. There's lots going on in the world of golf, never a shortage of anything. If you would be so kind and you listen to us through iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please give us a 5-star review. It helps us reach more people. You can download our show through Google Podcasts too, which is finally something you can use on an Android device to listen to podcasts. It's really nice, very easy to use. I would highly recommend downloading it. Or you can catch us on your favorite podcasting service, however you choose to do it. We're very much appreciative. Until next time, I'm Ryan Balaji saying thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.